Well, so what I'd like for us now to have is a silent session, and which is a very brief comment about, for those of us especially here in the retreat in Tuscany, in terms of the method or methods that you choose on your own, in your own private time. What I would encourage is to really focus on or emphasize the shamatha method that you find most helpful. It's really just that simple. So I will continue to introduce nuances and variations, different methods for the remaining 4 weeks or so of our retreat. And I, of course, when we're doing it here, I invite you to participate, people listening by podcast or eventually, apparently, live stream is coming on. Is that correct?
In a few days. Yeah.
In a couple of days?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So when that happens, that'll be nice too, and people can join us live. But what I would encourage you is, of course, as we explore new methods, week by week, Let's explore them together as we move through a bit more variation on the settling the mind, awareness of awareness, moving into vipassana, and then culminating, of course, in the actual Mahamudra and Dzogchen meditation itself. But in terms of your kind of regular diet, your daily fare, what I would encourage you to do is to just to focus primarily on the method you find most beneficial and not even worry about or have any consideration for the notion, is this a higher practice or a lower practice? As I've often given the example, if there's a locked door and you have three keys, gold key, silver key, and brass key, which key shall you use? Jody? You haven't heard this one yet. Michelle has.
The one that opens the door.
The one that opens the door, yeah. No, I didn't say that. That was a cognitive hyperactivity disorder. Projecting suddenly wasn't there. And they have three keys, but you'd think, well, the gold one's got to be better. I mean, it's worth so much more. And the silver, mediocre, and the brass, eh. But it's whatever opens the door. Whatever method works, that's the gold one for you. And so don't think about Theravada, Mahayana, Dzogchen, how high it is, how low it is, just whether it works. And then, again, what I love so many things about shamatha, but one of the major things that really, I don't know what the verb is, but draws me to it, is the total transparency of it. And that we just don't have to speculate. We don't have to wonder. We don't have to ask somebody. We don't have to wait until next life. Is it working? Well, what will be the long-term consequences? Will I have a good rebirth? Relaxation, stability, clarity. And in that sequence, sequentially and then synergetically. There it is. So what I'd like to do now is give myself a break. I'm going on vacation for 24 minutes. Let's enjoy a silent session. No need to record it. We'll come back and finish off this chapter from Kamachane. So let's return to and complete the transmission and commentary on this chapter from Kamachamata Muchi on Shamata. So he's finished his discussion of flawed and flawless Shamata. And then he goes on with a very, very, almost like bullet points, extremely concise, references to or description of moving through the different jhanas in the form realm. So picking up with the text, he writes, that shamatha is by having, once you've achieved shamatha, you've achieved access to the first jhana, let's say, In that shamatha, by implying an investigative analytical mind as an antidote to scattering, you're endowed with well-being and bliss, and the mind remains single-pointedly. And that is the first jhana. This type of description is exactly the type of description that lends itself to a lot of interpretations. And if people don't study the background literature, this is where the massive dumbing down comes down. You could read that, and this could be referring to stage two, prior to shamatha. You know, so this is why you just need to know. People who just read the Pali Canon and are dismissive of Buddhaghosa, frankly, I just think they're deluding themselves, unless they're incredibly brilliant. And whenever they interpret, they are interpreting something easier than what Buddhaghosa says. So that's extremely concise. I can tell you, I can unpack a little bit, but I'm not going to linger here. And that is in the classic descriptions I've received in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, how you actually move from, let's say, access to the first jhana, the second jhana, third jhana. You're practicing along that continuum. You're practicing what's called mundane vipassana. And it just simply has one theme all the way through. It's a very simple theme. You're going from that which is coarse, relatively coarse, to that which is relatively subtle. And you do use your analytical investigative ability just to assess what is the more subtle dimension of consciousness. And then you keep on moving towards the subtler and subtler. It's like a finer tune, or it's almost like moving to higher frequency consciousness. It's very rarefied. So this is interesting to look at, but by and large, I think Kamachamera Moche himself, I'm speculating, he's just referring to this as something, understand this conceptually, but the next chapter we're moving right back into Dzogchen. So in that first jhana, you are endowed with single-pointed attention, remain single-pointedly. That's one of the jhana factors. And it's investigative. So investigation, coarse investigation, that's a jhana factor. Subtle analysis, that's a third jhana factor. Sukha is well-being, that's a fourth one, and pritti in Sanskrit is bliss. And so these are the five jhana factors that are now very strong, they're robust, they're durable, when you fully achieve the first jhana. You have them, you can use them when you have only access, but they're kind of like fortified when you fully achieve the first jhana. You would have to be, I think, absolutely brilliant to read that one sentence and be able to know what to do to move from access to the first jhana. So I will just say this. If one is anybody listening by podcast or listening here, if any of you have the aspiration, I think I'd really like to, I feel a calling to actually achieve these jhanas. I've never seen anything so definitive, compelling, transparent, and inspiring for that path as Buddhaghosa. His presentation of how to move along the jhanas is just, it's just magnificent. And I've not seen myself anything in the Indo-Tibetan tradition that shows that degree of sophistication, precision, and doability, because you really know what to do. So it's just my perspective. Maybe it's just, you know, very prejudiced towards Theravada. But when I read the similar accounts, there's a whole genre of literature called Samzuk, in Tibetan, which has pertains to the form and formless realm samadhis. And it's very sophisticated. But as I read it, just from my own perspective, I just find it very academic. And my sense is that I just have never seen an actual meditation manual in any tradition, Gelug Kagyu Sakya Nyingma, that really strongly encourages and gives you a step-by-step account of how actually to achieve these. And again, for very good reason. Very good reason. They're busy. They have their lamrim or something comparable, and then they have stage of generation, stage of completion. They got the six dharmas of yoga of Naropa. They have Dzogchen and Mahamudra. They have the six bardos. They have all of these teachings, and these are all Vajrayana level. So why, if you have access to that and you have shamatha, you realize emptiness, and you have bodhicitta, why would you linger here? You know. So that's my impression. What do you think, Lynn? It's an impression. That's all it is. Neither one of us can speak definitively. That's an impression. So we're just going to move right on through here. But it's very true that when you've achieved the five jhanas, you do have those five jhana factors. There are all five there. And now we're going to see they drop off one by one, or two by two, as you go to subtler dimensions within the form realm. So that mind is lucidly, single-pointedly drawn inwards without needing to look out for scattering by means of investigation or analysis. That is the second jhana. So again, I would not try to use that as an explanation or practical instructions for achieving the second jhana. The gist that we can draw from that one sentence is that as you move from the relatively coarse first jhana to the relatively subtle second jhana, two of the five jhana factors fall away. You release them because they themselves are what is keeping you back. They are relatively gross or coarse, and that's investigation and analysis. Once you've achieved the second jhana, they've faded out, and you're left with only three out of the five. The single-pointed attention, of course. And then you have a sense of well-being, sukha, and the bliss, pritti. You have only three now. Two have dropped away. Remaining single-pointedly, so again, this is the common denominator. Remaining single-pointedly without investigation or analysis, without joy or sorrow, but with mindfulness and introspection is the third jhana. Here, joy is referring to joy is referring to pritti, that bliss or joy, something that is a real enjoyment. It's sharp. It has a real edge to it. It's joyful, blissful, delightful. That's gone. Sorrow is ancient history. There's no manifest dukkha. There's no suffering of suffering whatsoever in any of the form realm, anywhere in the form realm. But now you've moved beyond pritti, so you only have two of the five jhana factors. You have the single-pointed attention, and you have sukha, which is a more diffuse sense of well-being, in contrast to the pritti, which is a bit coarser, and that's more of the bliss, the joy that has a sharp edge. But if you're on this trajectory of going to greater, greater subtlety, you don't want the perturbation, the unsettling quality of bliss. You're going for complete, perfect equanimity. And so let alone suffering, that's a hassle. But you don't even want bliss because it's too exciting. You're prioritizing the sense of evenness, and that's what you get in the fourth jhana. Pure mindfulness. So now it's said in the classic literature that in the fourth jhana, mindfulness has come to its full strength. Pure mindfulness with unwavering equanimity. So now you have equanimity. There's no more sukha, sense of well-being. You've moved beyond that. There's no more pritti. And of course, there's no more investigation or analysis. So all four of those jhana factors are gone. No bliss, no sorrow, and with no respiration. So there it is. It's a definitive statement. So nowadays, a fair number of people in Southeast Asia, Burma, and so forth, and then Westerners who are following in their footsteps, I think they've achieved the fourth jhana. And maybe they have. It's not for me to say. But as Buddha Ghosa says, I'm not going to quote him again. It's there in plain sight, that if you've achieved the fourth jhana, it's not that your breath becomes subtle. Because your breath can become very, very subtle before you even achieve shamatha. Your breath stops, and it can stop for like 2 weeks on end. And during that time, you're completely immersed in the form realm. You're completely oblivious of your surrounding environment. As I recall, I didn't check it out recently, I just didn't see any need, but it's there in Buddha Ghosa. It's something like you can go in for 2 weeks, and if a bullock train with 100 wagons rolls right by, right next to you, you know, right in front of your meditation cushion, you have no awareness of it whatsoever. But your breathing stops. Your breathing stops for 2 weeks. Now ask any medical doctor what that should do to your brain. It ain't pretty. But this would be interesting if, you know, there's somebody who's not eager to follow the Mahayana path or the Vajrayana and so forth and so on, they really want to explore this. This would be of great scientific interest to see how can you come to such equilibrium that your body doesn't need any air. Because that's it. You're not holding your breath for 2 weeks. Your body doesn't need any air. It is so tuned, so free of wear and tear, so not consuming calories. It doesn't need any air. So it's a completely natural process. You remember I mentioned, as a hypothesis, don't know whether it's true or not, or whether it's only locally true but not, you know, more globally, 15 cycles per minute. But the fact that that is the frequency cited in the Vajrayana literature suggests, well, there may be something deep going there. But my suggestion early on, hypothesis was, that this is when breathing in short, one knows I breathe in short, breathing out short, I knows I breathe out short. And then, so then you come to this constant frequency. And my hypothesis is, you haven't achieved shamatha yet, but now just ride that horse. Attending to the whole breath you breathe in, attending to the whole breath you breathe out, and ride that horse. And you ride that horse all the way until you achieve the fourth jhana. Even long after you're aware of the tactile sensations of the breath, you can still be aware of the rhythm of the breath. Right? And the amplitude gets damped. A damped amplitude means that it's going smaller and smaller oscillations until finally, bee, looks like the person did, bee, no blip, bee, like that. As long as you're in samadhi. So the amplitude goes down, the frequency stays the same. That's my hypothesis. I would really truly be delighted for somebody to prove me wrong. That would be very interesting. I would learn something. So, this with no respiration is the fourth jhana. Now, of course, when you get up and walk around again, you start breathing again, because then your body needs air. Sampa Ranjun Dorje, again, one of the great Kambapas, he states, and this is now, he's just showing his source, with the antidotes of investigation and analysis, if you strive for single-pointedness, the result of delight arises. Delight is that pritti. And of course, there's sukha as well. This is the first jhana, single-pointedness without investigation and analysis, with inwardly directed lucidity. And delight and well-being, delight is bliss, well-being is sukha, is the second jhana. Single-pointedness with mindfulness and introspection, free of investigation, analysis, well-being, and sorrow, is called the third jhana. That should be not well-being. I just see a flaw in my translation. I don't know what the Tibetan is, but I know that the well-being, sukha, is still there in the third jhana. It's pritti that's not. So I would scratch out well-being and say bliss. Bliss or delight. Okay. As you can see, this is still a kind of a rough translation. And somewhere the Tibetan is buried in my library at home. I'd have to dig it out someplace. So this is the third jhana, pure mindfulness with unwavering equanimity. So now you've achieved, again, the perfection of equanimity, because there's not even a ripple, not even a perturbation of either pleasure or displeasure. And you're unaware of your body, so that's not even an issue while you're in samadhi. With unwavering equanimity, devoid of the eight faults of investigation, analysis, well-being, suffering, happiness, unhappiness, inhalation, and exhalation, is called the fourth jhana. So this is common point here. It's a remarkable claim, but it's not one that is unique to Buddhism. It's been known for, I think, literally thousands of years in the Hindu tradition, the great yogic tradition of India. They achieved all of these. This was all old science, contemplative science, by the time the Buddha came along. And if you recall his stepping out from his palace when he was 29, he sought out two samadhi masters in a very brief time. He achieved the fourth jhana and way beyond. And so the story goes. But this was all very well known. India really says, as far as I can tell, I'm certainly not a scholar of Chinese civilization, let alone of the ancient Greek or the Mayans and so forth and so on. But it seems to me, as something of a scholar in this area, I think India was just far ahead of any other civilization at the time of the Buddha. In terms of samadhi, each of the great civilizations had their excellences, and they shine like jewels. But one of the great jewels of India was, boy, they nailed samadhi. They had it so far ahead of anybody else, I think. And so then Buddhism made its way to China. Then they have a great samadhi tradition down to Southeast Asia, great samadhi tradition, and so forth and so on. But it was the Indian yogis, really. It seems to be they were the ones that developed this extraordinary contemplative technology. Which, on the whole, I mean, really quite widely, broadly speaking, until the time of the Buddha, they would achieve not only these, but we'll see the formless realms are coming up soon. They would achieve these extremely rarefied states of samadhi, and then they would get satisfied. And they would say, I found what I was looking for, moksha. And it was the sphere of nothingness, for example, in the formless realm, or it was the sphere of neither discernment nor non-discernment in the formless realm. So far, it seemed like they felt, and very understandably, but we should never be condescending toward these people. They are miles ahead of us in the 21st century. But they really felt, to use a modern terminology, they really felt for very good reason they had achieved escape velocity. And that is, they had gone so far into the depths of samadhi that they would never be snapped back. They would never be pulled back. That, you know, they're free. It'd be like sending a rocket so far away on a proper trajectory that the Earth will never get you back. You know, you're gone. You're a free agent now. And we've done, you know, NASA has done that. They've sent off to Mars and so forth. Now they want to, Stephen Hawking and some financier wants to, I think the financier put up $100 million to send a rocket to another star system, Alpha Centauri or something like that. But obviously, you do that, the Earth will never get you back, right? And so it's understandable, but Gautama, being the inconceivable prodigy that he was, he saw when he came out of samadhi, escape velocity had not been achieved. No irreversible freedom had been achieved, that it was just like a stretched rubber band, and then it snaps right back again. And you've never actually gotten out of samsara. So this is so far beyond anything that has been explored in the modern West, and probably any time in the West. That it's, you know, we're wondering whether this extraterrestrial intelligence, this is extraterrestrial intelligence. You know? This is so far out of anything we know in the whole Greco-Roman Judeo-Christian continuum. And one day we might wake up and recognize that there are civilizations on our planet who know immeasurably more about certain aspects of reality than we do. That idea is really not widely being entertained by modern academia. We're simply assuming that whatever we might have to learn from China, India, and the other great civilizations, we've already learned a long time ago. And now anybody who learns something new, well, we're it, or it's the, you know, other people that we've taught. So there's a kind of a wild, crazy ethnocentricity in that. We move on. Moreover, when such fine shamatha arises, again, all of this is called shamatha, because this is the whole continuum of shamatha. It is cultivated without attachment and craving. If it is cultivated without attachment and craving, it leads to the path. So all of this can be on the trajectory to give you a finer and finer, finer samadhi, which then you can use and apply to vipassana, and that takes you onto the path. So in the Pali Canon, the Buddha strongly recommended achieving all four jhanas. Strongly recommended. It comes up again and again and again. And so, and then if you use that fourth jhana, that extraordinary balance. Talk about objectivity. This is just sublime equanimity, free of any imbalances of desire or aversion, sadness or joy, and perfection of mindfulness. Well, you use that and apply that to vipassana. Well, you're coming in loaded. And that's when it leads to the path. On the other hand, if, as you're experiencing these more and more rarefied states of consciousness along the trajectory of the four jhanas, if you respond with attachment and craving regarding it, any of these states, as the highest state, the culmination, as moksha, and practice while thinking that this alone is meditation, in the short run you achieve tainted extrasensory perception and paranormal abilities. Tainted because they're still tainted with delusion, especially of reification, but you do not transcend samsara. So, now the interesting point here, these are just a lot of technical names in Sanskrit, is that these are not just states of consciousness. It's very easy to psychologize this in a very, you know, rarefied and sublime way, but it's not just states of consciousness. This is a major point, and it runs through all of Buddhism. And we see it, you know, it relates very deeply to the whole of Hinduism and all of the various gods within the Hindu pantheon. And that is that each of these jhanas corresponds not just to a state of consciousness, but to a whole dimension of reality. So you can be born in the first jhana, born in the domain of the second jhana, and so forth. And so he'll unpack this just a little bit. By cultivating the first jhana, you are born, cultivating and achieving the first jhana. So now you're fully immersed in the form realm, in this dimension of the form realm. You're born in one of the three Brahma worlds of Brahmakaya, Brahma Purohita, or Mahabrahma. So these are three celestial realms within the form realm. By cultivating, achieving the second jhana, you're born in one of the three worlds of Paritabha, Apramanabha, or Abhasvara. the Tibetans down below. By cultivating that, so again, each of these you achieve it, and if you're satisfied, then you basically bought yourself a ticket to be reborn in that dimension of reality that you've accessed by way of your samadhi while still a human being. So while you're still a human being, if you kind of basically act like a dog, you know, just completely, you know, base desires and so forth, then you'll get a form corresponding to how you use your human mind that's more fitting. Get to be born as a dog. You're acting like a dog, then you look like a dog. Here, your mind is ascending to these kind of celestial realms, and then you discard, when you die, you discard your human form, and you're actually born in that. And they have form. These are extraterrestrials. So who was it? I just saw something. Some video clip. Maybe it was Thomas Hertog. Maybe it was he. When speaking of the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence, it was a top-notch scientist. I watched it recently. It was a short clip. But he said, you know, if there's life out there, there may be life forms out there that as we are above single-celled organisms, they are above us. In a billion, 100 billion galaxies, each with 100 billion to a trillion stars, and they've been around for, you know, up to, let's say, 13 billion years, there could be some who are very highly evolved. Close encounters of the first kind. Contemplative kind. And the cool thing is, you don't have to wait till you die. You can access this. You can actually... This is like broadband. You know, the ordinary consciousness is like, remember we had modems that go... I think they did that just to make it irritating for us, so we'd be so happy when we transcended that level of technology. Because why it had to make such an incredibly annoying sound? Shall I do it again? Like that. And it's going out, glug, 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 you know, like a tortoise walking across a freeway. And go, oh, it's coming. And then we got broadband, and we think, oh, I remember in the dinosaur age, the dinosaurs had modems. But, you know, we've got broadband. Well, this is broadband. We're click, click, clicking in a 64K per minute, and this is broadband. This is where you increase the spectrum, broadband, of mental awareness, and you're actually able to see the beings, the inhabitants of that. That's what Yongtrin Rinpoche was saying, achieve the first jhana. You not only see Mount Meru and so forth, but you see who's dwelling there, because it's not just a big mountain. On levels and levels and levels, it's, you know, there are beings inhabiting it, and above it as well. You remember? That goes to the desire realm, above that is the form realm. So this would be an adventure. If you really would like to be a tourist of samsara, you know, like my parents really love to travel. They traveled, they went to all the continents, including the Antarctica, because they love to travel. And so if you really love to travel in samsara, this is the way. And you don't have to spend $100 million on a piece of metal shooting off like a bullet to one star. This is much cheaper. So by cultivating the third jhana, you're born in one of the three worlds of Shubha, Paritta Shubha, and Apramana Shubha. And by cultivating the fourth jhana, you're born in one of the three worlds of Anabhakrabha, Punya Prasava, or Britpala. Okay? So you are born in those due to cultivating shamatha, and non-Buddhist shamans and so on are born there too. It doesn't really have anything to do with your belief system per se. It has everything to do whether you have this contemplative technology, and it provides you with the Ural pass, basically, to, you know, to visit these different realms within the form realm. So it's the Rupa pass, the Rupa Dhatu pass. Non-Buddhists assert the attainment of just that as being the ultimate result. So he's referring exactly to the teachers of Gautama, who actually beyond this in the formless realm, consider that to be the ultimate result. And then there are domains of reality that are accessible, that are non-human, accessible only to Aryas, including Shravaka Aryas. If they're going to be a non-returner, for example, they may very well go to one of these realms. Avra, Analpaka, Sudrishta, Sudrsha, and Akanishta. Akanishta, and bear in mind, this Akanishta is a term common to the Pali canon as well as to the Mahayana tradition. Mahayana, this is the highest of the pure realms. This is not referring, none of these are pure realms. as in the Mahayana sense, like Sukhavati or things like that. These are simply very rarefied realms within samsara, which are kind of the last stop for Aryas on their way out, like non-returners. Shamatha by itself does not result in birth there. And ordinary beings, that is, ordinary beings, non-Aryas, those who have not had direct, unmediated realization of nirvana, do not take birth there. It is solely an abode of Aryas. Then we continue on. He's just given us just a brief, it's Tuesday, it must be the form realm, kind of very quick overview of the form realm. And now we go, and we're now going to have an equally brief glimpse of the formless. By stopping the discernment that grasped to the characteristics of luminosity and non-conceptualization, there is absorption devoid of, it should not be discrimination, a better translation, discernment. Discernment. Dushi mebin yomjuk. So now he's talking here about the formless realms, the formless samapatis or meditative absorptions. And this is the first of these. And he's calling this the absorption or samapati devoid of discernment. This one is usually called, just so you know, when you're reading around, like in Buddhaghosa, for example, he covers all of this, and he tells you how to achieve each one, I think with much more practical instructions. This first of the samapatis, or meditative absorptions in the formless realm, is usually called the formless absorption in boundless space. Boundless space. But here he's calling it the absorption devoid of discernment. And then this relates back to the basic Lamrim teachings. And remember the 18 qualities, the eight types of leisure of fully endowed human rebirth, you remember? And you remember among those is you're not born as a god who is devoid of discernment. Remember that? That's this. They live extremely long lives, you know, for, I guess, millions of years. And they're not dull. It's just that they're in this rarefied form that, you know, thousands of years could go by. Who knows? But very long periods can go by. But nothing's happening. They're not developing greater wisdom or compassion. They're just gone. But they're not liberated. And so it's called devoid of discernment. And he's equating this with the first of the four samapatis in the formless realm, boundless space. And that's how you do it, by ceasing to grasp the characteristics of luminosity and non-conceptuality. Bear in mind that you've already, long before, released any grasping to sukha. De selme dokpa, dewa sukha is one of the three qualities of achieving, resting in the substrate consciousness. That's sukha, well-being. They call it bliss, but it's sukha. Sukha, sukha, sukha. Well, to move along that trajectory under the fourth jhana, you've already released sukha. You finished with that one, right? All grasping to that. And now you're releasing grasping to the other two qualities, luminosity and non-conceptuality, right? And that moves you beyond the form realm. So by cultivating consciousness like space, upon stopping all appearances and attainment, there's the absorption of boundless consciousness. That's the second of the four meditative absorptions in the form realm. It's subtler than boundless space. By meditating without establishing either an object or any condition for an object, and without establishing anything whatever, the whole conceptual imputation process goes flat. There arises the absorption of nothingness. And that is, you've so deactivated your sentient being mind that you're just resting in a domain of reality where it's kind of like just universal substrate. I mean, it's nothing. Sheer nothingness. So that's what it takes. The materialists would like to think, lights out, all problems finished when you die, because you achieve nothingness. Sorry, you have to go through all the four you know, dhyanas in the form realm and get to the third of the formless before you get to nothingness. And then the problem is it still doesn't last. Because you get up there, and again, the propulsion, the karma that propelled you there, it's like a tire with a hole in it, and it's just going to run out. And they say this, I mean, in the Mayana tradition, I mean, it's pretty much everywhere. that none of these last. None of these last. They just all come back. This is why you absolutely need the vipassana, the wisdom. Because you can really understand. The first samadhi teacher of Gautama had achieved this. And he quite understandably thought, this is total freedom from samsara. Because it's nothing. It's the total negation of samsara. And of course he thought it would last. And Gautama, the young Gautama, 29 years old, he already saw, doesn't last. This isn't it. So is there anything beyond that? And yes, there's one more. And that is by meditating with the thought that subtle discernment is not non-existent, upon stopping the gross or coarse discernment of nothingness. So bear in mind, you're not just resting in nothing, you're aware of nothingness. You're discerningly ascertaining nothingness. You move beyond that. And then you achieve the fourth absorption in the formless realm. You take birth as a god in the absorption of neither the presence nor absence of discernment. And that's called the pinnacle of samsara. And Gautama is second, a samadhi teacher, had achieved that. Gautama achieved it very quickly. The teacher thought he'd achieved moksha. Gautama saw that he had not. Gautama then set out on 6 years of austerities and various other practices, seeing that samadhi by itself just did not free. Those individuals regard shamatha as the highest state. But since the mind is bound by subtle grasping, this is a revocation. There is the drawback that they do not see their own nature with vipassana. So all of that, you have been practicing vipassana, but it's mundane vipassana. Mundane to take you to the most rarefied, the highest frequency, the subtlest domains of conditioned existence, mundane existence. And you're still not out because it's only shamatha, not vipassana. So among the three higher trainings, your ethics is very likely to be extremely good. Your samadhi is extremely good, but the wisdom isn't there. Saraha, the great Mahamudra master states, one of the greatest Mahasiddhas of India states, childish people are seduced by the faults in the natural mind. By the faults in the natural mind, and all become thoroughly disgusted. Childish people are non-Aryas, ordinary beings, not just people who are silly. They're seduced by the faults of the natural in the natural mind, and all beings become thoroughly disgusted. Due to the fault of pride, reality cannot be pointed out. The whole world is confused by dhyana. So he's writing this centuries ago. I don't know exactly what century. I would assume something like the 10th, do you know, Glenn? The 8th, that would make good sense. So 8th century, well, this was golden. This is the century of Shantideva. This was the century when Nalanda was in full blossom, Vikramashila was in full blossom. Many, many great Hindu yogis, tremendous plurality or pluralism with Indian spirituality. Many people displaying, but certainly enough, displaying siddhis of a wide variety. It was not that uncommon. And so he's speaking here from this perspective of Mahamudra, where this was their high tech. These were their cell phones. These were their supercomputers and so forth and so on. And they're seduced by them. So we're seduced by our technology. The next big one coming looks like it's going to be a virtual reality. And many, many millions of people are definitely going to be seduced by that. The great escape from their boring, mundane lives. But the great escape without any of that technology for India 1,200 years ago, samadhi. Samadhi all by itself. You know, the great tour into the form realm, the formless realms, cities, paranormal abilities, extrasensory perceptions. It's no wonder they thought this was it. And it took a Buddha to see that it's just more samsara. And then, of course, achieving these, we can certainly sympathize. Of course you would. Why wouldn't you feel pride? But you have that notion that you've already achieved. This is why, I don't know even what the adjective is, but I guess distressed when I see people quite evidently making false claims, about jhana, about the essence of all Buddhist meditation, about stream entry, about nirvana, about rigpa, about mahamudra, and so forth and so on. I become distressed Because when people say that, then they've guaranteed they won't go any further. And when they teach other people that they've achieved, then if those people believe them, they guarantee that their students won't go any further. When people say the Buddha, some people say the Buddha didn't even believe in reincarnation or karma, didn't believe there was a path, didn't believe any possibility of realizing shamatha or vipassana. When people believe him, then that teacher has now just stopped them in tracks. He's like them, he's invited them to a soft concrete swimming pool. Jump right in. And now they're stuck until they stop believing that teacher. So that's where the distress comes. And it's not hostility like I want to hurt anybody, but it's bad medicine. And it's, as Daniel Boorstin says in his book, I've cited him many times, great big book called The Discoverers, History of Humanity's Discovery. He said in the preface, the greatest obstacle to discovery throughout humanity's history is the illusion of knowledge, not ignorance. So if you think you've already achieved moksha, you have that pride of, I've achieved moksha, I've realized rikpa, I'm a stage of completion practitioner, I've realized emptiness, I've realized rikpa, I've realized jhana, and so forth. Well, if you haven't, then the problem is now you won't. Because if you think you're already there, you've stopped questioning, you've stopped asking the question. And then if you teach other people, you'll delude them as well. So that's really sad. I put it that way. I'm speaking very gently here, because that's what it really is. It's not bullshit, I'm screaming my head off and so forth. That's just really sad. Because people are sincere, and they want to be free of suffering. And if you give them false medicine, you give them misinformation, it's hard to think of a greater disservice than that. You know, better just be quiet and let people be ignorant. At least if you're ignorant and you know you're ignorant, that's fertile ground. But if you're ignorant and you think you've already achieved something, you have this pride, then, as he says, reality cannot be pointed out. People become impervious. I've seen this so often. People become so attached to their own views that they just can't hear anything outside of it. It doesn't matter how much evidence or reasoning. And so, you know, there's not much point. And the Buddha himself, I'm just following the Buddha here, the Buddha himself did not run after these people and say, wait a minute, you got it wrong, I want to debate with you. He would teach them if people wanted to learn from him. But the first person he met who said, whatever, dude, and walked away, the Buddha just let him walk away. He didn't say, are you out of your mind? You've just met a Buddha, you knucklehead. Where are you going? I should lasso him. I'm going to tie you down and say, I'm going to repeat after me. You have just met a Buddha. You know, he didn't do that. Right? So if the Buddha didn't, then let alone a schmuck like me. Nobody needs me running after them. Reality cannot be pointed out, and in this world of 8th century India, the whole world of India is confused by jhana, because it seems widely believed, jhana is it, that's all you really need. Therefore, after cultivating shamatha by itself, so that's what this whole chapter was about, cultivating shamatha by itself. He's not touch vipassana, at least not super mundane vipassana that actually liberates, but shamatha, giving it its due. And I plucked out this chapter and included it in this retreat because overwhelmingly, throughout all Buddhist traditions, shamatha is not being given its due. Even though all four traditions, the great masters, all tell how important it is, in this era, which I can only describe as degenerate, it's being widely overlooked, marginalized, or dismissed altogether, or misunderstood, which is also equally common. Therefore, after cultivating shamatha by itself, the strength and excellent qualities of vipassana correspond to the greatness of shamatha. And he lays it out. Here it is. Couldn't be clearer. If shamatha is small, if you have relatively weak shamatha, the power of vipassana will be small. Just as little rain falls from a small cloud, or a small flame burns from a small piece of firewood. Therefore, now dispense with recitations and other religious practices, and do your best to maintain your mind single-pointedly. So he's writing this in the 17th century. When has this ever been ever more appropriate and timely than now? When so many people involved in recitations and religious practices of all kinds, esoteric. But as the old Tibetan aphorism goes, there are many profound practices, but very few profound practitioners. And the simple reason is we've not done the... You know, we just felt we could skip kindergarten and go directly to high school. You know, because kindergarten is so hard. you know, achieving shamatha. Oh, that's hard. Let's go practice six yogas of naropa instead. Oh, shamatha is hard. Let's go for dzogchen. Shamatha is so hard. Let's practice vajrayana. Goofy. So, do your best to maintain your mind single-pointedly. Get sane. Don't overlook the second of the three higher training as a samadhi. In this way, I have described the practice of shamatha. Thinking to dedicate the virtue of meditating to all sentient beings. Recite after me. Let's recite this together. I'll recite it after me. Why not? Because this concludes the chapter. So I dedicate this virtue to all beings in the six realms of existence who have been my mother. If there's a plague and millions of people are dying from the plague and suffering greatly in the process, like bubonic plague, something like that, or who knows what's coming up because these bacteria and viruses, they mutate so fast. The medical profession is waiting for the disastrous one to come along. It's immune to all of our antibiotics. So when a plague comes along, if there is, in fact, medicine that when properly administered and taken can completely cure the plague from the root, so you're completely immune to it, if there is such medicine, and it's being offered freely, and then there are others out there who are selling medicine that doesn't work, but they're claiming it's the best of all medicines. That's distressing. Because people will then take that and they'll just suffer. They will not be free of suffering. And it will just take their minds off. They won't even then consider. Especially if the medicine is more like anesthesia. Take this medicine, and your symptoms will still be there, but they won't bother you nearly as much. You won't be so stressed about your symptoms. You'll feel much more comfortable now that we've numbed you. That would be very distressing if, in fact, there is medicine that can free. And Kamachamaramache, and Tsongkhapa, and Padmasambhava, and Asanga, and Vasubandhu, and Sadaha, and Ranjan Dorje, and the Buddha, and Buddhaghosa. They're all saying there is real medicine out there. There's real medicine. They completely heal. So why should we keep reciting the mantra that we're living in a degenerate era? There are teachers that said, oh, we're living in such a degenerate era now. Nobody can reach the path anymore. Nobody can achieve shamatha. We're too coarse, too degenerate. Times are too bad. And all I can say to such people is, I agree with you. If you believe that, you're right. Yeah, that's true. If you believe that, if you believe that you're hopeless, and you believe your students are hopeless, and all you can really give them is practices that will give them really good imprints for future life, and you're really quite convinced that nobody can really achieve shamatha or reach the actual path, the Mahayana path of accumulation, nobody can really achieve, if you're persuaded of that, then you're completely right. You will not achieve. Because you'll never get the inspiration, the enthusiasm, the perseverance to actually put those teachings into practice until you come to the culmination. You'll never do it. And you're encouraging all of your other students to do so as well. So I feel very passionately about this. Not angry, but I do feel a lot of passion about it. And that is, this is the last 50 years, 60, whatever, is the first time that the Buddha Dharma from China, from Tibet, from Japan, from India, from the whole Central Asian region and so forth, has become a global phenomenon. It's the first time. It was studied by a few scholars, but, you know, by European scholars with very much a Western colonialist, imperialist attitude. You know, very, very much so. But only in the last, mid-20th century or so, are we finding the Dharma centers in Brazil and Argentina and in Australia and all over the place. It's the first time that Buddha Dharma has become global. Very fast, of course, with our transportation, communication, and many, many fine teachers traveling all over the world. So it's quite extraordinary. It took a long time, 2,500 years or so, before it became a global phenomenon. Asia, enormous impact on India, Tibet, China, and so on. But now, after 2500 years, it became, for the first time in history, global. I think it's an objectively true statement. And if on this occasion, if those who are carrying this lineage, carrying this light, like a long marathon, like a marathon, carrying this light through 2500 years, and now bringing this light to the world, if the message they're bringing is, you missed it by that much. That is 100 years ago in Tibet, 300 years ago in Sri Lanka, or what have you. Oh, we had people achieving really high states of realization, you know. But now, you know, it's degenerate. So all you can really do is just study, try to be ethical, be good, and pray for human good rebirth. What they're telling us is that after 2,500 years of pretty much being confined to Asia, when it finally becomes global, South America, North America, Australia, and so forth, they're basically telling us that Buddha Dharma is dead on arrival. You know, but here's a warm corpse, and pray over it and get some good karma, and pray for a good future rebirth, because times are so degenerate, nobody can achieve shamatha, vipassana, and so forth and so on anymore. That may be true, it's possible. People who believe it's true will be contributing to it being true. And those who hold even a little candle flame of hope, if anybody actually reaches the path, proceeds along the path, it'll only be those people who have hope, have conviction, have faith, and apply themselves with enormous and sustained enthusiasm. Isn't it true? I think it's kind of transparently true. And that's true for building a cell phone, it's true for getting to the moon, it's true for all the other extraordinary accomplishments that human beings have achieved over the centuries. Building pyramids, you had to believe it was possible. How long did those things take? And how much suffering and misery took place? But somebody believed it was possible, and then, you know, they carried through. And all of the other incredible accomplishments of humanity, however unlikely they seemed at the time, so many things have been accomplished. So quickly, too. I read in the newspaper now, in almost every household in America, somebody has something of a computer or a smartphone or what have you. And yet, 30, 40 years ago, I mean, people ridiculed it. Computers? Why would ordinary people want computers? This is like a great big box of, you know, a great big IBM that goes chicka, 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 chicka. You know, why would anybody want one of those? You know, it's a crazy idea. Then we had people like Bill Gates and, you know, Steve Jobs and so forth thinking, well, there we are. So, His Holiness commented, the only time when situation is hopeless is when you lose hope. So never do. That would be my suggestion. Never do. Doesn't matter how bleak, how unlikely it seems. Why lose hope? What's the point? What's the benefit? What's the upside of that? So let's read a little bit more. Now we go back to Pinchin and Butch's text. I'm making a lot of edits because we're now entering the shamatha section. It's an area where I have some interest for a long time. Quite a bit of interest, actually, for a long time. There it is. Okay. So, we'll just cover a little bit. We just have 10 minutes this afternoon. But we're in serenity. Serenity 2.2.3.3.1. Serenity. So we go to the text. Since this is the commentary, since that is the case, as stated, this is the system in which one seeks the view on the basis of meditation. So I explained that earlier. It's exactly the approach of Padmasambhava as he articulates in Natural Liberation. Since that is the case, what is the way to cultivate serenity first? So he said, view or meditation. Now we know, just like Padmasambhava, what he means by meditation, which of course is a great big term that can mean all kinds of things, in this context. Do you first cultivate the view and then seek meditation, or vice versa? I'm suggesting go for meditation first, achieve meditation, and then go for the view. Now we know exactly what he's referring to, serenity, and that's his translation. I'm not going to change it, for shamatha. It's a perfectly good translation. Since that is the case, what is the way to meditate on, or to, I should say, cultivate? You're not meditating on serenity. So I'm going to change that right now. What is the way to cultivate serenity first, shamatha first. There are preliminaries and the main practice. So there's a familiar refrain. So preliminaries, the exalted Maitreya explains. So now we're going down to the nuts and bolts. What are the necessary cause and conditions for bringing about the successful practice of shamatha? And the first of all, as long as you're embodied, you have to be meditating someplace. So what kind of place to meditate in? The exalted Maitreya explains, in what sort of place do the wise practice? It should have easy access to supplies, basic requisites of life, food, and so forth. A pleasant environment. I love that. I kind of find this pleasant myself. I don't know about you, but looking at it, it's kind of like, it's okay. It's really okay. One that's pleasing to the mind. When I look out on this magnificent landscape here, I don't look out and say, how much does it cost per acre? How much could I buy? You know, I'm not thinking that. It would be course of nice to have up there for a retreat center, but in terms of, boy, I wish I owned some of this property. It's like, well, it doesn't invite that. I don't think it does for any of you either. Like, boy, I'd like to buy that valley. The beauties of nature don't tend to arouse. Well, then I think about La Salle. All that belongs to France. Okay. There are some real weirdos, primarily from Europe, that they would just say, well, that belongs to me. Okay, but for normal people, being in a pleasant environment, just as one of my beloved and revered lamas stated, Sakyadamala, the woman lama, she was asked, what is the role of beauty? It was asked by a Westerner. This kind of question just doesn't come up in the Tibetan tradition. And she was asked, what is the role of beauty in spiritual practice? As in a pleasant environment, the beauties of nature. And she said, oh, beauty is so important. It makes the heart happy. You know. And so at its best, that's exactly what it did. It doesn't arouse attachment, craving, clinging. Look at the great monasteries of the Christian tradition and the Buddhist tradition. Look in Japan, look in China, look in Tibet and so forth and elsewhere. And you find the hermitages tended to be in really gorgeous spots. Right, with great views. So for good reason, pleasant environment. Good land. It should be a healthy environment, not one where you can easily catch malaria or dengue fever, Zika, or hepatitis and cholera and typhoid and parasites and worms. Oh, yes. So be in a healthy place, you know. Good friends. Good friends are not just good chums, but people who are really good for you and you're good for them in supporting each other in spiritual practice and not getting each other's way. So a yogic community, a contemplative community, is a very loose-knit community where if someone gets ill, the other ones are right there to help him or her. But they're not in each other's face. They're not there to socialize. They're there to plumb the depths of the mind to gain realization. And they're there just we need it to support each other. So it's a very lightweight, very sincere, very heartfelt connection of spiritual friendship, but it's absolutely not a socializing community. So that's what a good conducive environment is. And there should be the requisites for yogic bliss. Okay? Requisites, well, all the inner qualities. These are described next, and that is abiding with pure morality. There's the first one. Pure morality. You must have pure ethics. Otherwise, you may as well go home. Abiding with pure morality in a location thus described, with few desires for anything you don't have, and content with what one has. So those are really crucial. If you miss those, you may as well go home. Have few desires for what you don't have, and be content with what you do have. One must rely on the branches or collections of serenity. These are the requisite conditions giving rise to serenity, and definitely accomplish the six preliminary practices. Okay? So, these are the Jowayanlatu, or Jochodu. And these are not unique to any one of the six schools of Tibetan Buddhism. These are preliminary practices, preparatory practices, but I was introduced to this maybe 30, 35 years ago. And what I really liked about these is that these are not something you get through with, you get finished with, and now you can get a move on to the main event. These preparatory practices, these you continue practicing all the way till you know, up till not including your enlightened. And they are, and you'll have this on your on the website very shortly. Here they are. And listen to this. This is just now, this becomes part of your routine until you're enlightened. Sweep and clean the room. Clean up after yourself. It's not like mom, you know. Clean your room. Don't be meditating in a pigsty. Come on, kid, grow up. You're not a teenager anymore. Sweep and clean your room and arrange the altar. Create a sacred space. So you're not just meditating in a hotel room or just someplace where you happen to sit down. Arrange the altar. Create a sacred space. That this is like, as neuroscientists have their laboratories and musicians have their conservatories, so does contemplative need a sacred space. Arrange the altar, a place that gives you a focal point for your devotions, icons, representatives of your objects of refuge. Arrange the altar. Make offerings on the altar, such as light, as in candles, food, incense, water bowls, and so on. Sign of devotion. It's symbolic, but symbols can be very, very powerful. So, sacred space. Sit in a comfortable position and examine your mind. Okay? Sit, and if you can't sit in a comfortable position, then lie down in a comfortable position. You should be comfortable. Examine your mind. Check your mind. What's the mind you're bringing to the practice? Do breathing meditation to calm your mind. This can be simply mindfulness of in-and-out breathing, which is widely practiced as a preliminary exercise in Tibetan Buddhism, like counting 121 breaths. Or as we'll see shortly, there's also a ninefold breathing exercise, kind of a pranayama exercise that you can do. So balance your mind with breathing, either the natural breathing of mindfulness of breathing or the ninefold breathing we'll get to shortly. Then establish a good motivation, renunciation, bodhicitta, that would be good. After that, take refuge and generate, so get a good motivation and then go on beyond that. To take your refuge and generate the altruistic intention by reciting the appropriate prayers, so refuge and bodhicitta. Okay, so now you're creating a space, a mental space, that's loving, that's gentle, that's safe, in which you can enter fearlessly. You have a sense of refuge, just have a sense of safety, but also benevolence. This is all imbued, your practice now becomes imbued with bodhicitta. The next one, visualize the merit field, that is the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the great Bodhisattvas, the Arhats, your Gurus, and so forth and so on, those in whom you're taking refuge. Visualize the merit field with the spiritual mentors, the Gurus, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and so forth. You can include Dharmapalas, Viras, Dakinis, and so forth, Arhats. If this is too difficult, if you find it difficult to visualize sometimes the very elaborate field of merit, then visualize Buddha Shakyamuni Buddha and consider him the embodiment of all Buddha's Dharma and Sangha. So just one, the synthesis of everything. And if you're practicing Vajrayana, well then, the Buddha is indivisible from your own guru. Offer the seven-limb prayer. We've covered that already in Shower of Blessings. There are many, many versions of it. That's a nice one, but there are many others equally good. So here it is. Here's just the core preliminary practices, the homage, the offering, the purification, the taking delight in virtue, the requesting that the wheel of Dharma be turned, requesting the light ones not pass away into nirvana but remain, and final dedication of merit. I mean, that's just absolutely core for accruing merit and purifying obscuration. So this is a keeper. You don't say, how many times do I have to do it? Just keep on doing it until you're enlightened. Offer the seven-limb prayer and the mandala. Offer the mandala by reciting those prayers. There's corresponding liturgy. Make requests to the lineage spiritual mentors or gurus for inspiration by reciting the requesting prayers. So these are prayers of supplication. Prayers of supplication. So this will all be on the website very shortly. So just a tiny bit more. So seated on a platform, there we are. So one must rely on the branches and definitely accomplish the six preliminary practices. There they were. And if you Google it, you can find there's a very nice presentation of this in various ways. But the Gelungma Tutenchuden, one of my old chums since we were both like 14 years old, she's a very fine nun, a good scholar, a wonderful teacher. And she has a nice entry on this on the web. You can easily find her name and this and the six preparatory practices. Very nice. So I just gave the concise version there. So then, We go to the root text, seated on a platform. So this would normally be a cushion, conducive to meditation. It's a platform. It's an interesting term. It's an accurate term. Then, your body seated on a platform conducive to contemplation. Your body in the 7-point posture. The 7-point posture. This is classic. 7-point posture, sitting cross-legged. It's the posture of Varochana. They are very briefly. This too will be on the website very shortly here. Your legs in the Vajra, the full lotus position, or the half lotus, or it can be the Bodhisattva position, seated cross-legged. Your hands in the mudra of meditative equipoise, left hand beneath, right hand on top, thumbs touching. Wisdom, method, union of method, wisdom and method. So the second one is the mudra. Third, your back should be straight. Fourth, your jaws should be relaxed. Your jaw should be, the jaw muscles should be relaxed. Tongue against the palate, that's four. Tongue against, just lightly touching the palate, holds the saliva in the mouth so you don't drool. Head tilted forward, just slightly, a slight incline of the head. Eyes slightly open, gaze directed downwards, very gently downwards. Shoulders level and relaxed, so there's no notion of hunching up like a vulture. This is the classic teaching. So shoulders will level, don't be tilted, and relaxed. So that'll be all sent out momentarily, right after we're finished here. So your body in the 7-point posture, there it is. If you're comfortable, if you're not, then remember Upatissa, the arhat, supine position, good. Walking, standing, not good for shamatha, good for vipassana. So be somewhat flexible, but this clearly is the classic instruction. Clear away stale breath, the residual stale prana, or breath, through the 9-round breathing, distinguishing well between. So there's that, the 9-round breathing. I'm not going to explain it. It's very simple, and you can read it and you can understand it perfectly from the PDF that I just sent out this morning. So that's online here for our website. I just plucked it off the internet. It was really, really good. I thought I have nothing better to say than that. So just read it. It's not indispensable, but it's widely taught, and it can just kind of clear out the whole system. Not like achieving shamatha, but it's a good start. And then distinguishing well between clear and sullied awareness. So as soon as you start, recognize with introspection, is your mind clear or is it sullied? Is it a bit vague, dull, and what have you? If it is sullied, you might want to say, well, maybe I can just go ahead and meditate and clear it away. Maybe you should go out for a walk or have a cup of tea or something like that. Okay? So that's that. So we'll continue. So now we've really entered into his explicit teachings on shamatha within the Mahamudra tradition. And Penchen Rinpoche definitely, very clearly, explicitly draws strongly on the Kagyu tradition for this presentation of shamatha. So I was introduced to this, I told you, 40 years ago, deeply inspired by it, practice it. And this, as I recall, the first time I've ever taught it. So hopefully it'll be helpful. But the transmission, a commentary there is there. I've been authorized to teach it, so that's where this is coming from. Thanks to Geshe Rabdin. So enjoy your evening.